Promise not to pour tea on it.
Tonight, I'm happy to have Ann Hill here. She is the author of What to Do When Dreams Go Bad. I hope you'll explain that.
Sure.
And she is going to speak to us tonight about creating a dream culture. Thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers. Welcome.
Thank you for the introduction, Jim. It's great to be here. I will explain the title a little bit. What to Do When Dreams Go Bad is a practical guide to nightmares. And I chose the title because I wanted to, remind people how bad dreams can feel when they come and they're really sort of scary nightmares. And at the same time, insert a little humor in there because, you know, dreams can be like errant teenagers. And you're just like, come on, stop it. You know? So that's kind of my approach to dreams. And I want to acknowledge the full range of emotions they can elicit from us and states of being that they can send us into, while just implying that there's no dream that is unrehabilitatable. You know, there's always something in a dream that is. Do you want to come through? Sure. No, not a problem. So that's my, and I wanted to make it small so that people don't have to read an enormous book just to figure out how to deal with that freaky dream they had the night before last. So that's my nutshell pitch for the book. I also brought little dream bags from their herbs, most of which are from my garden. I grow a lot of dream herbs out in Bodega Bay where I live, and so those are $3. You can just give money to Jim if you want one, and I have a bunch more here. So I'm going to talk about creating a dreaming culture, and this is a talk. Well, it's really a discussion cleverly disguised as a talk. Jung used to, he wrote somewhere in all of his voluminous writings that every time he would sit down with a patient and listen to their dream, he would always remind himself at the outset, I know absolutely nothing about this dream. You know, that was sort of his safety, because there's always a point in a dream at which you think, I have absolutely no idea. So the same goes for my, this talk is basically a talk about the questions that I'm asking myself and asking my dreams and asking others about dreams and how not only how to create a dreaming culture, but what that would look like, what that would entail, how would it be possible to use dreams to be more cognizant of our dreams, not only our internal nighttime dreams, but the dreams, come on in, you guys. But the dreams that we share as a culture, the American dream being first and foremost, and all the cultural myths that we partake of are in like collective dreams. So I have a lot of thoughts about it, and I'll sort of outline how I got here and what I'm thinking at this point, and then I'd love to have actually a discussion. You know, if people have questions or comments, it would really, I think this is how we create a dreaming culture, is by actually talking about dreams in whatever format. So thank you so much for coming. So, well, in one sense, every culture is a dreaming culture because we all dream. And, I mean, that's just part of the human condition. We are dreaming animals. And so every culture that humans are in has a form of a dreaming culture. The question is, how functional is it? How able are we to use dreams for our betterment and for the betterment of other people around us? So that's kind of where I'm going. At this point in the West, dreams are still fairly much the purview of psychology and psychoanalysis, and there's a whole history about that. But it starts way back, well, it could start anywhere, but I'm going to take an arbitrary point of starting and say that it starts back in ancient Greece and in the Mediterranean region, where there were these really interesting dream temples. So in the ancient world, there was, just like there is now, there were a lot of different ideas about what dreams were, you know, what they meant. Most people believe that dreams were messages sent from outside, gods or demons or spirits or people, other people sending dreams. And so there was a grave concern that, like for instance, in Homer, there's a dream that actually comes to, it tells a lie. The dream tells a lie, you know, comes dressed as a message like you should do X, but all to deceive somebody so that this other story could be set in motion. So there was a concern that even with strong dreams, even with big message dreams, we could be misled. So it was very important to have, to be in a place that was safe, a safe space for dreaming. And in the ancient world, that was a space that was set aside as a temple. And every temple had a patron deity. So you see temples to Apollo, and temples to Asclepios in particular, very, very large, we would call cult, but you know, it stretched for 1,200 years, from 600 BCE to the last Asclepia temples, 600 AD, before they were either destroyed or sort of morphed into some early Christian temples. So what these places had going for them was that they were sanctuaries. They were pilgrimage spots. They were, because of the presence of the statue of the god or goddess, Persephone was also a very powerful deity for dream healing in the ancient world. So because of the presence of the statue, it was a sacred spot. It was sanctified, and the dreams that you had there, you could rest assured were good dreams, were true dreams. So we have this history, and we know a lot about this. Well, we know a lot about certain parts of it. We don't really know what the training was for the priesthood. Some temple traditions were men and women were in charge of dream healing. Others were, you know, all we know is what were written in the temples that have surfaced. So, for instance, in the Asclepia, Asclepios was a god of healing who there's a lot of overlap between him and early Christ figures. So the gentle healing man god was, you know, began with Asclepios, and he had a beard in most pictures, and he had a staff with a single snake twining up, not the what we call the caduceus, but so this was his healing staff. And he was also, he had a little sort of an aspect as a very small, sometimes you see a small boy or almost a little gnome or a dwarf figure. And so all of those figures were represented somewhere in the temple. And if you had a serious illness or injury, you would go to the temple, or even a big crisis of some sort, you go to the temple. There was a purification process you would go to, and you would basically sleep in the temple when people judged that you were ready, and then you would receive a dream of healing. But it wasn't a dream like we think of dreams, like, oh, in my dream, you know, the taxi driver said, here, take this $50 bill and go book yourself a hotel. And that wasn't the kind of dream they had there. Not the least of which they didn't have taxis. But they would actually have a visitation by Asclepius, or there would be a snake that would touch them and suddenly they would be healed. I mean, it was like a direct communication. It was like a transmission dream. So that's borne out by a lot of the lead the little pieces of lead that people would inscribe sort of their testimonials. I came here, and I was unable to walk, and now I'm walking home, and it was a miracle. And so little boys appearing in the dream, which was one of the aspects of Asclepios, or the snake, or Asclepios himself, and then that was that. So very different from how most of us experience dreams. So that was the kind of the first when I started researching early dream incubation history, and that's what it was called, dream incubation. You would go to the temples to incubate a dream. So dream incubation history is full of these kinds of stories. And it, at a certain point, the stories start to shift. And I don't know for certain, but it's my hunch that it starts to shift at a certain point when the priests become more diagnosticians. Because you see these dream reports in the temples that were more like, I had this dream which told me to eat seaweed for 2 weeks and, you know, do this type of physical therapy, and then I was healed. So, and so it's all really interesting. I don't want to get too much into that particular place in time, but it's interesting to me that the dreams change over time there. And at in the island of Kos, one of the biggest Asclepia there is where Hippocrates and his father and his grandfather were all Asclepian priests. So, you know, modern medicine has always traced its roots back to the Asclepia. The first set of surgical tools were unearthed at the Asclepia on Kos. So there's this way in which dream transmission healing became dream prescriptions. And it kind of, to me, mirrors how the Western dream work has evolved in terms of psychoanalysis. So two major subject matters or specialties trace their roots directly back to the dream temples, and that's psychoanalysis and medicine. And religion does too. I mean, the Catholic Church, she is a little bit kind of embarrassed. They don't really know what to do with some of their early churches, which had been Asclepia and then turned into temples to various saints where people got the same sort of transmission healing. But that's, you know, all three prongs are there. And so that tradition, it's still alive today in how we think about dreams. So, for instance, when you read Jung or C.A. Meyer, who was a student or a contemporary of Jung's, who wrote the first book about the dream temples, he says, this is where psychoanalysis came from. We are the descendants of the priests in the dream temples. So, given all of that, where we are today is, we've had mostly dreams in the West, and I'm talking really broadly. I don't want to really argue about what culture means, but I know it's an open question, but just sort of, you know, with that caveat anyway, here we have dreams have been pretty much from Freud, their wish fulfillment, or they say really embarrassing things about us, and they're best understood in psychoanalysis. So what happened in the, really right around when Jung started becoming read and popular, the 60s and 70s, there, a bunch of people realized, well, wait a second, these are dreams, these are sort of the commons. Dreams are part of the commons. We shouldn't have to, they shouldn't only be the purview of psychoanalysis. We should be able to derive the wisdom from our own dreams. So the grassroots dream work movement, for lack of a better word, really began, and one of its strong roots is here in the Bay Area. A bunch of people, Strephon Kaplan Williams, who just passed away last year, developed Jungian Sonoy dream work, where he tried to come back, using Jungian principles about the collective unconscious and the archetypes, and also trying to get people, trying to develop ways to re-enter dreams. Strephon Kaplan Williams had amazing ways to look at dreams and try and get back into them. So dream re-entry became part of the lexicon of the grassroots dream work movement. And so there's been this whole rise of dream groups. Exhibit A, part of my dream people to you tonight. And, you know, so people, you're sort of saying, well, I don't know anything about psychology. I don't know anything about comparative mythology or anything, but I'm kind of interested in dreams, and let's just kick these dreams around, not metaphorically speaking, and see if we can figure out what they mean. So it's all kind of a rich stew. And one thing that I've found, and you guys can feel free to argue with me if you disagree, is that in the years that I've studied dreams, it's kind of dawned on me that the way we look at dreams has still a lot of threads into, you know, self-help and psychology kind of minded things in a way that may be impeding somewhat our efforts to really understand dreams. And what, when I say that, what I mean is that we tend to, if somebody tells you a dream, you tend to see the fissure, the place where something goes wrong. Like, oh, everything was going right, and then I got in this car and it crashed. Well, why did it crash? And you kind of, your mind goes right to the problem in the dream. And some dream work that I've experienced feels very, very critical. You know, you're all trying to piece together the sort of what did I do wrong, how can I fix it mode of thinking about ourselves, which is very, you know, it's very self-help minded stuff, right? We all want to sort of get better in, you know, the human potential. How do I get to my full potential? It focuses on what's wrong here, what's out of balance. So when I started thinking that this might be the case, I started wondering, okay, well, what's the remedy for that, right? How can we, if we want to approach dreams as a more holistic phenomenon, how do we look at them in a different way? And so I started thinking about, well, what if we focus on the good stuff? What if we focus on what's going right in the dream? What if we focus on the moments of beauty? And even really disturbing or very anxiety-ridden dreams, that most of them will have a moment where something really beautiful occurs. Like there's a view of an amazing, you know, landscape, or something good happens. So why do we always go to the bad? So when I'm working on dreams now, I really try and at least be aware of how much attention I'm spending on what's wrong with me, how can I fix it? And how much I'm saying, look at all the dream has to offer. And look at how the dream is presenting this as a whole. It's not just saying the car crashed, it's saying all this other stuff too. So how do I sort of adjust my attitude about dreams? And so that's kind of the nutshell version of how I came to these ideas of this question of how to integrate, or is it possible to integrate ideas of direct transmission or ideas of literal minded, of literal interpretations? There's a lot of dream cultures in the world where dreams are considered messages still. Sometimes people, I come across people who are convinced that their dream is an actual message and that's the content of the dream. But I was taught that all dreams have multiple levels of meaning, right? So how do we reconcile our Western attitude toward dreams with, say, the gentleman I met from Samoa, who said his mother she's sort of the family dream interpreter, and you tell her your dream, and let's see. So the rule goes, and this is a rule, and it's sort of, he'll say, yeah, you know, 15 years ago, somebody had a dream, and, you know, it still holds true. So the rule is, if you dream about a funeral, there's going to be a wedding soon. If you dream about a wedding, there's going to be a funeral soon. Not only that, if you dream about a cousin on your father's side, something's going to happen on your father's side, but not necessarily that cousin. So it indicates, you know, the side of the family, but it doesn't have to be specific to the actual person. And this is just, you know, this is like common knowledge. You put ketchup on your hot dogs. Duh! You know? So, and the gentleman I met from Senegal who says, well, yeah, I, you know, a woman was having trouble getting pregnant and could not conceive and could not conceive. And then she came to me and she said she had a dream about being bit twice by a snake. This was a woman in her 40s. She'd been married for, you know, this is a Muslim culture, so she'd been married for 20 years. And so she dreams about being bitten twice by a snake. And he says, well, by the end of the year, you'll be pregnant with twins. She said, that's impossible. And sure enough, by the end of the year, she was pregnant with twins. So she has twins right now. Yeah, I know. Well, yay. Or like, oh, geez, poor thing. Or whatever, you know. Whatever your outlook on having twins at 40 is. But still, I mean, how do they get that? And how, not only that, but how can we think about different types of dream interpretation? If I say to my friend from Senegal, well, okay, that sounds like that was a legitimate interpretation, but, you know, my view is that all dreams have multiple levels of meaning, and so there's got to be some level of this dream that, which is inherently about my internal psyche and the fact that, you know, blah, blah, blah. What's true in dreams? And so that's kind of what my question, my open question to the universe is. So if anybody has anything to say, feel free, I'm going to take a little sip of tea.
Well, would you think it would depend on the culture then? That our dreams would tell us something maybe different than somebody in Senegal's dreams would tell them?
Yeah, I that's an open question too, because I've had my dreams analyzed by a friend of mine who's a Yoruban priestess, right? So a Nigerian dream tradition. She gave me an interpretation of my dream that was radical and very direct and literal, and I thought, well, maybe it was another snake dream. You know, snakes are tricky little creatures. When they come in dreams, everybody, so many different interpretations of snakes as a symbol. Which one do you go to? Are snakes a symbol of power? Are they a symbol of sexuality? You know, like is a snake sometimes just a snake, you know? Or
and, you know, I have dreams of cars oftentimes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But I think that depending on the culture, maybe a snake becomes a car or a computer or something, that it's just what we use, the symbols that play in our world, mm-hmm. in this culture, mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and snakes, to me, for a long time, I had a lot of snake dreams. And I thought, oh, snakes are good and powerful and, you know, raw, raw snakes. And I worked with the snakes, and the snakes were biting me, and the snakes were going this way and that way and chasing me and other people. And you know, a decade, 15 years of snake dreams. And then finally, I had one where the snake was really mean and was just wanted to bite me, and there was no way the snake was not going to bite me, and I was holding it right behind the base of the head, and I was said, I'm not going to let you bite me, and I as long as it was struggling to get out, I was going to keep squeezing it, and I could hear the little vertebrae cracking, and it still wanted to bite me, and that was the end of the dream. And that was the end of my snake dreams. It's like, I'm not going to let you
snake.
So killing the snake worked for me again. I don't know, but yeah. So, you know, that's my musings about it. Yes.
Sorry. Did something change in your life then?
Lots of things changed in my life.
I mean, right at that point.
After you conquered the snake.
After
you conquered the
snake.
Yeah, I got divorced. But you know, but that was not where I was going with the snake imagery all those years. Like, no, this is actually my internal power, and this is, I mean, that was true too. But then there was also this literal interpretation that my friend had pointed out years ago, and I was thinking, well, easy for you to say, you know. But so there's two things that I think make our type of dream work different from other cultures. And I just want to sort of bring these out a little bit. One is this idea of literal versus symbolic interpretations. So if I, for instance, if I have a nightmare about somebody coming into my house, right, and it's an intruder dream, and I wake up and I'm totally frightened, the literal interpretation of that is, I'm going to go make sure all the doors and windows are locked. Mm-hmm. Obvious go-to response, right? Mm-hmm. But what about if the intruder in my dream is somebody that I actually know? do I then, once I've checked all the locks, do I then call this person up in the middle of the night and yell at him or her for, you know, like how far do we go in this literal idea? As opposed to, what if I have a real symbolic approach to dreams, like an intruder in my house, okay, my house is myself, and there's an intruder, is that my animus figure trying to come in? Should I, like, it, you know, welcome this person, or should I, you know, am I trying to set boundaries in my life? So it's all this kind of internal work, which is incredibly valuable and really helpful. And how far do I stay in that realm, and when do I check the doors and windows? So that's kind of a, I mean, it's kind of a paradox in dreams. And I mean, in my book, I tell people to first check your doors and windows, and don't email anybody. Do not make it worse. You know, first, do no harm. Hippocrates always said, should be the prime directive of dream work. Do not do harm. So, but then consider that there are multiple layers of meaning. The other distinction in dreams is the difference between collective and personal meanings. So, yeah, you're nodding for Rita. You know, so, for instance, if I had a dream about, if I had a dream that felt very prophetic, like, oh, there was a dream I had several years ago about, it was the Delta out in Sacramento Delta, and I was talking with this person I know who's a biologist and environmental sort of political guy, and we saw this layer of plastic just covering the Delta. It was just like, it was round, it was like a contact lens or something, just like covering it, and just feeling how you could touch the edge, but you couldn't lift it. And at that point, that just felt to me like, what a horrible and true statement about our ecology, our environment. There's this layer of plastic over everything, not just externally in all of our lakes and rivers and creeks and watersheds, but also internally, we're so removed, we're so separated by our cars or by our lives from our immediate surroundings. It felt very prophetic and very true on a collective level. Many cultures have dream traditions where dreams are shared for what they tell the people about what's going to happen next. Is that a dream about a storm that's going to come? And should we, you know, do X with our herd, or, you know, this and that with our crops? So dreams are often used for foretelling. Now, sometimes people in the West use dreams for foretelling. Sometimes we have those dreams that just seem crystal clear, like something is going to happen. So how do we reconcile that with our notion that dreams are also about internal things? Is it? And the other interesting thing that I've come across is just about everybody has their own taxonomy of dreams. And by taxonomy, it's sort of dreams fall into different categories. Oh, this is an anxiety dream. Oh, that's just a mind babble dream. Oh, that was a true dream. You know, that was a big dream, that was a little dream. How do we know? It's endlessly fascinating to me how we categorize our own dreams. And do we do that because that's what's true for us, or that's sort of our response? And I mean, my experience is that a lot of people who discount their dreams as being very small dreams actually have quite big dreams, or just very big messages in these seemingly small mm-hmm. dreams. So, to my mind, every taxonomy of dreams is a useful place to explore, but it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all of what's in that dream, of what's in that dream to be discovered. And what I find in dreams that feel very collective, dreams that feel like very sort of prophetic and profound in a societal, how they're painting something that's going on in the culture or the society, sometimes they're impossible to think about in terms of personal meaning, because they just, it's so easy to see exactly, and it's so kind of almost poignant, you know, how well they match an external reality. And sometimes it's only years later that I realize, oh, right, that was also a reflection. For instance, that Delta dream, just the past year I've realized, oh, right, that was kind of, I was actually so locked in that sort of contact lens looking plastic thing. It was also a reflection of how locked in I was to a certain view of things. You know, my worldview was pretty much locked down tight. I couldn't really lift it quite and see things in different ways. So, I mean, what I do with people who come to me with dreams that feel very, you know, externally true, kind of like the ancient Greeks when they would have dreams that were messages, and that meant I need to go, you know, walk 2 weeks to that other village or that city state over there and meet a certain person and ask them about something, ask them about my dream. You know, if I have a dream like that, if I work with a dream like that now, kind of like with nightmares, I'll say, yeah, go there, do that, but also be open to the idea that it's got that there's other levels of meaning in your dreams. So I'm curious, has anybody here had one of those kind of dreams that just is pretty much a direct message? Do this, go there. Yes, Cynthia.
Yeah, I had a dream where I walked up to the top of a set of bleachers to the moon. Mm. The moon was there, and this loud voice said, "Don't do anything for 9 days until mm-hmm. the new moon." Mm. And I had been out of work at that time, and my first thought was, "Don't look for work," but I didn't. It was so clear. I didn't, and then on the ninth day, it was a Sunday, I looked in the newspaper, in the one ads, and there was a job for exactly what I do, which should never be in the newspaper, it's too specialized. Yeah. And I called them, I got the job, and it was the beginning of a huge, it was a major opportunity in the beginning of a whole new way
wow.
of life that's still yeah. playing itself out. So,
wow.
And I just knew, it was that same thing
yeah.
that you're talking about,
yeah.
man. I just knew.
Yeah,
I'd never gotten such a clear message before,
yeah.
and I just had to obey it.
Yeah.
It was hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People change their lives over dreams. I was just talking to a friend who said, yeah, I had a dream like that, and it said, go back to grad school in religious studies. Boom. 90-degree turn in life, and that's what he did. It's just compelling. It's so compelling. So I guess my question is, have you found other layers of meaning in the dream?
Or? Well, I was thinking about that as you yeah. were talking. I think, I don't know if we worked on that dream.
I remember it.
Okay. Oh, no, then you guys know the answer. All I remember is that I didn't do any, I didn't look for work for 9 days, and then I got an amazing
yeah.
opportunity.
Yeah.
That's all I remember, but
yeah.
these guys know.
We helped you arrive.
Did
they?
So I think one of the, it's interesting, I've been to a lot of dream conferences where people talk about ancient dream cultures, dream incubation in particular, and people get really kind of territorial about it. Some people will say, well, it's not a true dream incubation if you're not in an ancient temple site doing exactly the same thing that they did 2,500 years ago. And if and unless you have a dream where the god appears to you and you have a healing, then it's not a true incubation dream. That's kind of setting a high bar there. So we're all supposed to go back to Epidoros and, you know, sleep on the cold stone? That doesn't sound like much fun at all. Well, but it begs the question. You know, this is our lineage, for lack of a better word. This is our tradition. And people are constantly going to sleep with a problem and the dream comes to them in sleep. So there's, I think that there's more going on than meets the eye, and you sort of scratch the surface of a person who says they never dream or they never remember their dreams, and then you'll get this whole amazing dream life. When I was 7, I had this recurring dream, and it made me go into the profession that I'm in right now. Well, really? You never have any dreams? So I think that we tend to think of ourselves as as kind of in this, removed from our dream reality and removed from the dream world and removed from the whole idea of a dreaming culture, when the truth of it is that we're way closer. We're just sort of immersed in it all the time. And I guess that's my primary point that I wanted to bring out, is that that we're all dreaming all the time, and we're still having kind of amazing dreams of visitations. I can't even tell you how many dreams I've heard about people whose, you know, loved ones appear right at the moment of death from thousands of miles away. And you just know.
Yeah.
You just know. And there's no second guessing it. I mean, later on they might second guess it. I had a client come to me very upset because she'd had this profound dream, and then the Jehovah's, a profound vision actually, a waking vision of somebody that was on the threshold of death, and then this Jehovah's Witness came to her door and started telling her how there's no spirits. She's like, I wanted to strangle this woman. So we all have that. And I guess another question that I have for you all is, how do you work with dreams? Do you think about dreams in your daily life? Do they guide you at all? Are they sort of background chatter?
I do a journal. I dream journal.
Dream journal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if something's really poignant and I wake up and then I write it down and I just kind of play with it and see how it comes out in my daily life.
I usually write a dream. If a dream really... I've done dream work for many, many years, and so if I were to spend all my time writing my dreams, I would never do anything else. I would, don't do that anymore. But a dream will, you can have a dream almost every night, some kind of dream, but aspects of a certain particular dream will speak to you right away. Mm-hmm. So that's the dream that I pay attention to, you know, especially if it's bringing up people that I haven't seen for a long time, or situations that are presenting themselves that I thought were over, or were, you know, something like that. And so it's coming then again. So to pay closer attention to the, I never tend to take the dreams literally, you know, like in exactly literally. But I think they're way too salient in your life, continuously present, to not pay attention to, to some degree. You know, so, yeah, I think they're always have parts of them from time to time that are really valuable, very valuable.
Yes.
My dad passed away in December. And when my son told me that my dad passed away, I felt like a light went off. Then after that, I started dreaming every night that it was dark. I was always in a room that it was dark. On the street, there was never light. It was really strange. So, and then as I felt better, then my dream went back to normal again.
Came back, And you could sort of tell, oh, I must be getting better now.
But the light, you know, when the light went out, as soon as I found out, and then my dreams, they're all in the dark.
Well, welcome back. Yes. Sorry, Judith.
I was thinking, my dreams are like friends. They're like friends. And very often I get a sense that they don't want interpreting.
Yes.
They don't want understanding, and that the gifts that I receive from them somehow can be more powerful. And I just allow them, and it's just straight accept them. And healing, of course, comes.
So you sort of hold them as a sort of a meditation, or sit with the imagery, or just let it sort of percolate?
Not even that?
Yes. Go ahead.
I got into the habit when I, you know, dreams were so vivid or so
profound. You don't always have someone to talk to about. And then I think, what do I do? If I write it down, I know I have so many journals, I never read them. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I started painting. Painted all my dreams.
Oh,
and as one day, I can at least talk about it, or I keep that image in mind, keep that somewhere in a framework that's more my, a style that is more tangible than words. So it's good. That worked really well. I mean, I actually wrote my pieces on dream.
Oh, wonderful.
Doing artwork. Interpreting the art.
Yeah, I'm a talker and a writer, so that's my normal mode from dreams. I don't by any means mean to imply that there's not other amazing ways to work with dreams. So I don't want to give that impression at all. Jude, you had some discussion?
Yeah, I was going to say that we've been doing dream work so long that I'm finding that an interesting thing that's happening with me is, and I'm sure this isn't an uncommon experience, where you wake up and you've got the tag of a dream, but you can't remember it. And then you're doing something into your day, and you reach for a dish, and you go, oh my God, that yellow bowl. And it triggers. And then I'm finding that, so that's been a common experience, but what I'm finding starting to happen now is a certain amount of confusion about, was that a dream, or did I really see that?
And
it doesn't bother me, because I don't feel like any need to really resolve the issue, but I do feel that the line starts to get a little blurry.
Yeah.
And that is partly from accepting dreams as a certain level of reality, as opposed to saying, well, in the real world versus my dream, instead of what we say in our dream group is in waking life and in my dream. And it seems to kind of elevate the important aspect of what dreams do to us and for us.
It's all the real world.
Exactly.
This is part of it, we're waking and part of it, we're dreaming.
But I find that's been an interesting thing in the last couple of years of just, which world am I in right now?
Am I the butterfly dreaming I'm a man?
Yeah.
Roxanne, you had a comment?
Well, I read your book about a year ago, I guess. And since then, I've just given myself more permission to pay attention and languish in my dreams. And I love what you said about doing this hand. I don't have problems with nightmares or anything, but they feel like little spirit guides dreams. And sometimes I just want to, kind of feel, hang on to them all day. And it's almost hard to speak about, but I know what you mean. They feel friendly, helpful.
This is sort of off topic, but it was generated from this discussion. I think there's a lot of people in the Western culture who read some astrology thing every day in the paper or online these days. So my thought is, if dream interpretation was as clear-cut as reading an astrology thing, that we would be a culture so comfortable in using our dreams, accessing our dreams daily, and believing that it was real, instead of just believing what somebody wrote a little cookie cutter for my sign. Because they're so specific to us. But we haven't made that bridge yet.
And part of me is a little bit ambivalent about the whole thing. I mean, my question that I'm sitting with is, how do we create, what is a dreaming culture? What would a dreaming culture look like? And how would we create it? And then would it be a good thing? I mean, would it? I guess, and yes, is I'm sort of 90% yes. And 10%, there's such a draw to theocracy in this society, in this country, that I don't necessarily think we want to go back to the dream priestesses or dream priests or anybody else having the kind of power that they used to. I mean, actually, dreams, the history of dream incubation goes back to the city-states, and dreams were used to guide, to develop laws, to dispense justice, to determine where, if the city, if the the city was getting too big, if they had to hive off and start a new, the dream would lead them to where they had to start a new little, you know, village. I don't necessarily know that I want a hand to what would either would be a priest or a priestess, that type of power. So I have a little ambivalence about it, but I'm interested in what a dreaming culture would look like from a lot of different viewpoints. I think that's a really crucial discussion to have, or at least a crucial thought to have sort of floating around in the back amidst everything that's not extremely urgent that we have to think about, you know. What would that look like? What would it be like if we actually, over the breakfast table, shared our dreams?
That's what we used to do at our house.
I know. It's a great conversation starter, for one thing.
All my kids were into it.
You know, that if you read the laws about Twitter rules and Facebook rules, that one of the big no-nos is never don't tell your dreams.
Oh,
because
really?
Because they're boring to everyone else. So that's one of those rules of thumb.
No kidding.
Which makes some sense. But
oh, no.
People are...
But how boring could 140 characters be?
I wanted to ask you if you've seen the Red Book yet.
I have seen the Red Book, just not in any great depth, but
I just was curious what your response. I've only seen the outside of it in shrink wrap.
You know, we used to have a lot more free time. That was my first thought. Damn! To have the time to take this big book and these gorgeous illustrations and the painting and the amazing script. Woo! That was not a 21st century occupation.
Can you tell us what that is?
The Red Book is Jung's Red Book. It was just recently published after being under lock and key for however many years, and it's basically, you know, Jung's inner journey and the material from which he derived all of his theories and, you know, constructs and so forth.
It's not just work, it's painting.
Amazing.
And his visions.
It's
a gigantic, it's like $200 big old.
In some chapel in New York, it's on display, or it was.
Yeah,
on display.
I have a friend who has the one with the vellum, and you can only have the gloves on. And they, you know, it's like a cult almost.
But I think those Jungians, because he was worried about his reputation.
Yes, that's right.
Being a mystic rather than a scientist.
So that poses a really good question. I mean, that's a really good way to look at the idea. And how are we doing for time, Jim? Are we?
I have 8:25.
Okay. So. Here's a guy who was such a game changer in the culture, right? Jung, brilliant guy. If you look at the Red Book and the visions and the dream things and all of the stuff, I mean, this is kind of in some ways it's a story of a breakdown. You know, what we would consider somebody kind of going down into the depths and maybe coming out okay, but it's sort of touch and go there for a while, you know? So this is the stuff that he kept hidden from most people, although he did give some copies out to, partial copies to a few people. But from this came this amazing, you know, lexicon. I mean, every time we talk about the anima and animus, Jung should get a nickel. You know, every time we talk about the shadow, ka-ching, you know, or the collective unconscious or the archetypes, it's like Jung's thinking and his concepts have so entered the mainstream. I mean, kids are talking about their shadow, you know? I mean, it's just kind of amazing what was revolutionary in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s is now... I mean, he's shifted our whole way of thinking about the psyche. And so he is a great example of somebody who had an amazing effect and derived all of that really from his own dreams. The Red Book was a record of his dreams and his process of sort of, you know, breaking with Freud and developing his own sense of self and his own lineage, really. So it's kind of, yes.
I think that brings up something related to your question as to what a dreaming culture would look like. Mm-hmm. And it seems with Freud, Western civilization was given the message to that we cannot trust our what is subconscious, mm-hmm. which is why so many people do not trust their dreams. So off the top, to me, it would seem that a dreaming culture would be one where there would be more trust of the self mm-hmm. and therefore of others. And I do think it's a fabulous thing that the Red Book wasn't published early on, because he's cast a seed into the future to, I think, erase some of the effect of Freud's message. Mm-hmm. And so more people will be opening up that here was this man who did this wonderful, beautiful thing and stayed sane, if you want to use that word. And now people can learn from him. What, mm-hmm. 100 years after his death? Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I think trusting, I mean, just general impulses in a dreaming culture would include trusting. Not only trusting dreams, but trusting oneself. You know, going back to where intuition isn't something to be feared, but is something to be noticed and paid attention to. And the idea of one's, you know, internal compass deriving from something more than one's career path would be a great place to start, I think. So there's all sorts of really profound changes that come when we start trusting dreams, start paying attention to dreams, start conversing about dreams. Yes.
I was just remembering that there's a relationship between vulnerability and dreams, because when we're sleeping is when we're in our most vulnerable state, and it's so there's a relationship between that state, the state of total vulnerability, and the emergence of the dream. So it's the mistrust that we guard in our, or that we hold in our waking life, that kind of separates us from the dream state or the dream life. That there is an integration between those two, between the two states, mm-hmm. the waking and the mm-hmm. dream state. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the mistrust that keeps us from that. Mm-hmm. And the dream state is so mystical, mm-hmm. and it's the mystical quality that is so nourishing. Mm-hmm. So if we could be getting that nourishment when we're awake, how wonderful that would be.
It would be wonderful. Yes, Diane.
When I heard the title of your talk, I had a completely different idea of it, which was developing a dream culture where you develop skills and intentionality and community in the dream state, repeatable experiences. And so, when I, you know, as a psychedelic user, I think that's definitely a possibility. But the question that I have for you is, would you remark on developing skills over a lifetime within the setting of dreams? I've watched my own skills of flight develop just wonderfully. Mm-hmm. You know? Now I can sit down in a chair and fly around.
Yeah.
You know, from having to leap or swim or something. You know, now it's like so easy. You know, it's like sometimes it's like skateboarding. Sometimes it's like it's so wonderful. Mm-hmm. So what about developing skills within the dream set?
So you're talking. You're kind of going even beyond the changing patterns of behavior and you know, habitual patterns and actually developing certain, like, intentional dreaming, sort of lucid dreaming.
Yeah, many times when I'm in a dream, I realize that I can make a choice. But I step back and I go, okay, I can either, like, do something intentionally, or I can just see what happens next. Mm-hmm. You know, and I usually go with see what happens next unless I'm really not into it.
And now you're going to be killed.
Right.
Well, I don't think I'll go there.
I mean, I think that point that you're describing of realizing in the dream that I have a choice is key. I mean, if we, and to me that comes from observation and awareness, and sort of conditional talking and thinking about our dreams and holding them close and sort of, you know, doing the Rubik's Cube thing or painting or however we engage with that material, coming because that the more we can, it's like a feedback loop. If we bring what we dream into our waking awareness and do whatever it is that we do with it, that activity translates into greater clarity, if not lucidity, in dreams. So those awarenesses of where we actually, there's two choices, or maybe we're being given two choices and we think in the dream, wait, there's actually a third choice here. Those kind of moments are really doorways into whole different engagements with our dream characters and just the act of dreaming. So I don't know that there's necessarily a goal that I would want to go to, but that's kind of, that's the effect that I'm looking for, is being aware of the choices that I have in dreams, you know, being aware of all the possibilities that exist, or at least more than one, you know. Yeah. I don't know if I want to hold all of them, but at least more than one would be nice.
And then in the dream itself, either making a choice or choosing not to choose. I mean, sometimes I think, sometimes you can make the choice and nothing happens, you know, nothing changes, but...
Yeah.
But where does that point of will come in, and does that interfere with the subconscious information?
Oh, that's a good question. This will be, I know we have to wrap up soon, so the question of will is really important because, you know, there's this idea that we can, and it was floating around a lot in the 70s, I think, that, you know, you can... unleash the power of your dreams or control your dreams or somehow you can be master of your dreams, which is ludicrous, right? And so you've got ego awareness, which is our waking awareness, and then there's this whole sphere surrounding it of psyche, of awareness, of consciousness, thinking that this one little beam is going to like last through the rest of it. Silly. I mean, it's just so grandiose. It's kind of laughable. But so what I think is that these two things can work in tandem. So when I'm, you know, I think our will is important, but our will does not run the show. You know, we are co-piloting or whatever. Yes.
On that theme, I have a friend that does this thing where she asks a question before she goes to sleep.
Yeah.
I want to get direction on this issue. Yeah. Is that somewhat of what you're talking about?
Yeah, we can definitely, and that's a whole other topic, which it's fascinating, actually. There's a lot of different things that come out of that. But, yeah, guidance and receptivity is way more important than saying, I demand a dream about where I'm going to find $5,000, you know, something like that. It's you might find it, but chances are your dream will say, come on, try again. So that... we have to, let's see, I had one more point I was going to make about that, and it has slipped my mind. Mm-hmm. You had one more question?
We have one small comment. One time I was meditating, and I had the insight that my dreams are just thoughts.
Yeah.
During my waking time, I have a consistent flow of thoughts, and when I'm sleeping, the thoughts are still there, but I'm just not I don't have the awareness to do, you know, whatever I do with the thought during the day.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't know, but I just remembered what I was going to say. You just gave me the cover to retrieve my thought. Which is there? So there's this thing about, you know, we can get control of our dreams, right? And then there's the sort of the opposite end of that is if we go too far into dreaming, we'll sort of lose ourselves in the ether and become, you know, we'll sort of lose our traction on the ground. You know, we'll cease to care about whether our children are fed or whether the garden is, you know, that's the sort of fear of the unconscious. And so I would just, you know, to sort of maybe shift both of those a couple degrees. My preference in all this would be to have the openness and to have the awareness and the trust of dreams and of all its, that whole sphere of consciousness, and to keep the discernment of the waking mind and the ego, and and see if they can play well together, or at least share, learn to share. 5-minute turns, you know. So I'd like to, my vote is for both. So, thank you so much for coming.